It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered. I'm home.
You're like fighting a woman?
You're saying Vince McMahon is stupid. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, my God. We're only an hour in.
Eric Bischoff is an idiot.
We have 2 more hours of this.
Maybe the single stupidest idiot that ever got into wrestling.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and threaten me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
I just love it when I have all my notes set for the podcast, and I attempt to enjoy some time to myself on a Saturday night, and then news breaks. If I manage to get all my prep done early, you can set your watch to it. Something is going to happen. This is episode 758 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Double or Nothing Sunday, which just got a lot more interesting. Sunday, May 29th, 2022. I am the Solo Monster. We've got 13 matches scheduled for tonight, which is a lot, but it might be down to 12, depending on whether or not MJF actually shows up. There's a lot of things going on behind the scenes right now leading into tonight's show. Tony Khan also stacked the card because he doesn't want the CM Punk Hangman Page match to compete with the Celtics and the Heat in Game 7 of the NBA playoffs. In fact, he flat out promised on the AEW Unrestricted podcast this week that Punk and Hangman will not go to the ring until Game 7 is over, which I'm sure pleases all of the international fans, especially the ones in the UK where it's already very late, who cannot possibly give less of a shit about the NBA or any US sports. It's going to be a very late night tonight. But hey, the Rangers are also going to a Game 7. I'm not even a big hockey fan, but I'll probably watch that over Raw on Monday night. That sounds way more exciting. Let me say thank you to all of our PayPal supporters. You guys came out in full force this week. If you want to make a PayPal donation to support the show, you may do so on thesolomonster.com. You will see the PayPal link at the top of the page. And that may be changing. There might be a link tree going up. So just if the site looks a little bit different in the days ahead, you will still be able to find the PayPal link up top, so that should not be changing. But $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out. I want to say thank you to awesome Anthony Anguiano, who is wishing everybody a happy Memorial Day weekend. I second that. The Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton, John Loose Cannon Lopez, Night Stalker, Nayef Al-Safar, James Hollywood Herrera, Big B Brian Pissera, Beast Mode, Brock Joseph, Killshot, Keith Hart, the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, Shin, Superkick, Akuma, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, John Raging Mad Riffle, the Firebomber, Craig Foster, New York Punk, Arnold Modesto, the Alabama Assassin, Chris Young, you are awesome as well, Iowan Corn Farmer, Jesse Lampier, the Hacker, Joshua Edwards, thank you for the suggestion, my friend. And the Goddess of Justice, Samantha Turner, who just turned 31. Happy birthday. And the Hairless Potato, one of my favorite PayPal names. The Hairless Potato, Ed Kiley, who has started a fundraiser for the Cork Simon community, which helps the homeless in Ireland. He is running in the Cork City Marathon. He is trying to raise whatever funds he can for a good cause. I love the URL. It's an easy one to remember if you want to contribute. It is idonate.ie/bipolar rock and roller. That's rock and the letter N and then roller. So again, idonate.ie/bipolar rock and roller. Also, this is Memorial Day weekend, and so Pro Wrestling Tees is running a Memorial Day sale. So if any of you have been on the fence about wanting to buy a Sound Off shirt, waiting for a discount, now is the time to do it. You can get 20% off all shirts in our store with the code MEMORIAL22 at checkout. Make sure you get that in, though, before tomorrow afternoon when the sale ends. So go to ProWrestlingTees.com/SolomonsterSoundsOff. House of Glory hosted a great show on Friday night, Holy Grail, from the NYC Arena. Always a good time calling the action with JD from New York, Sam Laterna, and Dr. Hillary P. Wisdom, the good professor. Will Ospreay unfortunately missed the show with a kidney infection. He is said to be on the mend, but he had to pull out of a whole bunch of shows. He pulled out of a Rev Pro show last weekend and unfortunately had to pull out of the Hog show as well. But low-key did not go without an opponent on Friday night. ACH stepped in and the two of them had a battle. Charles Mason, still the crown jewel champion with a win over Cashflow, Ken Broadway. Jonah advances in the tournament to crown a brand new House of Glory heavyweight champion with a win over Jeff Cobb. 48 hours after Cobb appeared on AEW Dynamite and laid waste with Great O'Khan to FTR and Roppongi Vice, and Trent Beretta chokeslammed himself through a table. Doesn't get any easier for Jonah in the next round. He takes on Eddie Kingston. And the Briscoes, Jay and Mark, retain their House of Glory tag team titles over the main event, Midas Black and Jay Lyon, the greatest show on earth. A tag team that you are going to be hearing a lot more about in the future, I promise you that. They have been a Hog staple for a while now. They came into the show 3-0 in their last three matches and nearly had it won, but they fell just short. A fantastic match. If you missed any of the action, you can catch the replay on Fight TV. And keep your eye on the House of Glory YouTube channel as well. There's going to be more content popping up there in the days and weeks ahead, just to give you a feel for the product if you've never seen a show before. But we got to get into the top story here. And this is a developing story, even overnight. More details have been coming out about this. The situation with MJF and AEW went from bad to worse in the last 48 hours, if all of these reports are to be believed. You've got names like Sean Ross Sapp and Mike Johnson insisting that this is not a work. And these are people who are not known to break news like this if it doesn't feel legit, if it isn't legitimate. But this is also MJF that we're talking about here. I don't think we can completely discount the possibility that we are being worked to some degree. I think you always have to keep that in mind when we're talking about MJF. But it does sound like there are some very real problems going on with him right now, that this is not just part of some big elaborate work, it was all just some grand scheme that they concocted. There are very real problems going on here that could have a big effect on tonight's show, where he is in one of the biggest matches of the night. It's not like he's in some match on the mid-card. It's not like he's in some kind of battle royal. They don't have a casino battle royal this year. They don't need one because they have 13 matches. He is in one of the feature bouts on this show. And right now, as it stands, it's 50-50 if the match is even going to happen with MJF and Wardlow. So how did we get here? On Friday, MJF no-showed a meet-and-greet with fans in Las Vegas. AEW has taken over Las Vegas this entire week. They were live in Vegas on Wednesday for Dynamite, Friday night for Rampage. They've been having all kinds of fan events. And MJF no-showed his meet-and-greet that he was scheduled for. And the word making the rounds at the event was that he was deliberately not attending, and AEW officials were not able to get in touch with him. Either his phone was off or it was on and he just wasn't answering their calls. Fans who paid for MJF for photos and for autographs were offered refunds and exchanges with other talents that were there. Mike Johnson said that he heard from several readers that at the time that he was scheduled to be at the meet and greet, MJF was seen playing slots at Mandalay Bay instead. So he was definitely there. He just chose not to show up. Now, to make things even more interesting, a flight was booked for MJF out of Las Vegas. A red-eye flight was booked for him cross-country to Newark, New Jersey, which would have meant that had he gotten on that flight, he would not have been a Double or Nothing tonight. He did not get on the flight. That is the last update. He was not on that flight. Doesn't mean that he can't still fly out, that there can't be another flight booked for him, but he was not on that plane. He is still in Las Vegas, at least as of the time I am recording this. But based on when that flight was booked, this was not something done impulsively at the last second. There was thought put into this. It was done and booked far enough in advance that thought was put into the idea that maybe he might get on this plane and go home and fly back to the East Coast. Now, I addressed the MJF situation on the podcast last week. There has been a change in the relationship between him and Tony Khan. It stems at least in part, although now at this point, this feels like just a small piece of it. But it stems in part from AEW being upset that he did not clear with them in advance an interview that he had given to Ariel Helwani. He just went and gave this hour-long interview to Ariel on his show many weeks ago. And it was actually a really good interview. And it's one of those MJF interviews. You don't really know, you know, how much of it is real and how much of it is him just working. I mean, that's kind of the beauty of the MJF character. You know, he can go and do these interviews and talk about, you know, being buddies with Bruce Pritchard and wanting to go to WWE and all of these different things and say, oh, I watch all the WWE shows. I'm a big fan of everything. I watch Raw and I watch SmackDown and I watch NXT 2.0. No wonder this guy is so cranky. I would be too. But there was nothing wrong with the interview. The issue is that he didn't clear it with the AEW PR team in advance, which I guess is standard practice, and they weren't very happy about that. But a lot of it also has to do with money. And whatever MJF is making, it is not anywhere close to what people like CM Punk and Bryan Danielson are making, and possibly other big names that Tony Khan has brought in from WWE over the last few years. Even though MJF has been one of the best parts of AEW television and is one of the biggest stars in the entire company. You know, when he was signed, he was not the level of star that he is today. He sees all of these people making more money than him, or assuming that they're making so much more money than him, and he wants a bigger piece of the pie. The issue seems to be that Tony Khan is willing to give him more money. And I talked about that too. I said, look, when this guy's contract comes due, you've got to break open the bank vault and do whatever it takes to keep this guy under lock and key. So it's not a case where Tony Khan is not willing to break open the checkbook and give a big fat pay raise to MJF. He's willing to do that, but not without him signing a contract extension. MJF is under contract until 2024. I've heard January 1st, whatever the exact day is. He is under contract with AEW until early 2024 at some point. He has at least another 18 months left on his deal. They have expressed a desire to sign him to a new deal for more money, but he does not want to sign a new deal. And you can understand why. He knows that there's going to be a bidding war for him. He wants to pit Vince McMahon against Tony Khan for his services, and he is likely going to go with the highest bidder. I've talked about the television rights fees that are going to be coming up for AEW and for WWE as well, almost at the same time. And it's all right around the same time that MJF's deal is said to be up. This is a man who is in the driver's seat. This is a man who stands to make a lot more money if he just holds out a little bit longer. But he doesn't want to wait. He wants more money now without signing a new deal. And I totally understand Tony Khan's position on that. I would not throw more money at him either without knowing that I had him locked in for a longer period of time. Otherwise, all you're doing is you're giving in, you're giving him more money, but you're also basically handing him to the competition. MJF has made it very clear in interviews that he is not signing a damn thing before his contract is up. I wouldn't either. But if that's the case, he can't expect a big pay raise until he actually sits down and does put pen to paper. That's just, I side with Tony Khan on that. Now, it also looks like MJF was not very happy about something that Tony said during the Double or Nothing media call a few days ago when he was asked by someone, I don't know who it was, about the MJF situation. You knew he would be asked about this. And Tony said that wrestling thrives when real life intersects with what's on the screen. There was no free agent market when AEW started. That has changed. The match is a huge opportunity for Wardlow to become an official part of AEW and be something more than MJF's thug. He said that everything else MJF has brought to the conversation about his gripes and his contractual discussions and other issues only adds to the interest in the match. Regardless of how this all pans out, I think we can all agree that's 100% true. Because all anybody's been talking about over the last 12 hours is this MJF situation. They're all wondering what's going to happen. Is he going to show up? all anybody is talking about. So absolutely, it has certainly added more interest into this pay-per-view. But MJF saw that and he tweeted and then quickly deleted, fucking LOL, fuck this place, man. So this is not good. This is not a good place to be. People are going to compare this situation to the situation with Sasha Banks and Naomi walking out on WWE. These things happening so close to each other. They're going to make those comparisons even though the two are not even remotely comparable. First of all, Sasha and Naomi spoke with WWE management. They voiced their concerns to their bosses. They took a meeting with Vince McMahon. MJF, by all accounts, hasn't even been on speaking terms, or is barely on speaking terms, with Tony Khan and people in AEW management. He's been more isolated, he's keeping to himself, he's not talking. When they tried to reach him this time, he didn't even answer his phone. Outside of a cryptic tweet and delete here and there, there has been no communication from the MJF side. That's one big difference. Another big difference is that the issue with Sasha and Naomi, and again, I have to caution, we still have not heard their side of the story from their own mouths. Now, there might be legal reasons for that, but we haven't heard from them directly. And I'm going to have an update on the Sasha and Naomi stuff a little bit later. But their issue on that night, at least, was with the creative that was laid out for them. They didn't show up demanding more money on an existing contract that they're already signed to. That was an issue with bad creative. This is an issue with what MJF evidently feels is a bad contract. Now, if Sasha and Naomi had no show to fan meet and greet where people paid upwards of $100 to see them, I would have less sympathy for their cause if they would have walked out before the fan event. I don't know why, frankly, they even bother booking MJF for meet and greets. It doesn't make any sense to me. They're booking this guy for meet and greets. Him of all people on that roster, he's the one who should be exempt from doing meet and greets. But they had people who paid $150 to come see the guy and get shit on by him. Because I guess that's the thing to do. I mean, I've seen reports from people at these meet and greets where MJF is sleeping at his table. He won't even lift his head up to take pictures. Or he'll rip up someone's photo and hand it back to them. He's a heel. He's a heel. He's very good at that. But I guess people pay top dollar for that kind of stuff to be abused. He should have shown up for the meet and greet. That was wrong. Samoa Joe also no-showed his scheduled meet and greet, but that's said to have been a communication issue and not something that he did on purpose, in which case AEW needs to do a better job of communicating with its talent on where to be and when. When you have two people no-showing meet and greets on the same day, albeit for very different reasons, that's a black eye for the company. But there's one other major difference between the MJF situation and the situation with Sasha and Naomi. And this, to me, is the most important one. And the reason why I think MJF is making a very big mistake if he does not show up to do this match tonight. I think he will, by the way. I think he'll be there. I think we'll get the match. But on Raw, a couple of weeks ago, they slapped together a six-pack challenge on short notice as a TV main event, which Naomi was scheduled to win. The person the match was designed to put over is the person who chose to walk out and no-show the match. This is very different. This is an advertised pay-per-view match, a match that, even though it was only made official 4 days ago, is a match that has been building for months. And the person scheduled to go over, most likely, I mean, we don't know for sure what Tony Khan's plan is. I'll do my predictions in a little bit. But the person most likely winning that match is Wardlow. And Wardlow is the one who gets fucked over the most in this situation. If MJF no-shows this pay-per-view tonight, he is the one, Wardlow that is, that I feel bad for the most in all of this. It would be a horrible, horrible thing for MJF to screw over Wardlow in the biggest match of this man's life. This is his big moment. You know, it's one thing for him to have a disagreement with Tony Khan and choose to go home, breach his contract. Sasha and Naomi did the same, knowing what the consequences might be for them. MJF should know there will be consequences if he chooses to do the same. They at least talk to their bosses first. Do what you need to do, but don't fuck over Wardlow in the process. Show up, work the match, put the guy over, and then go home if that's what you feel you have to do. Nobody can force him to go to work just because he has a contract. If he doesn't want to go, if he has issues of some kind, he can go home and do what he wants to. And yeah, again, there'll be a price to pay for that. But if that's how he feels, if he has his reasons for doing so, then by all means, after tonight, go ahead. Fly yourself home. Fly back to Plainview. And then you can work things out with Tony Khan in whatever way you feel suitable. But if it comes down to getting more money, go ahead. Try to get more money. Try to get that bag. You know, look, the guy deserves it. If the guy is being underpaid relative to some of the other big names on the roster, then he deserves a pay raise. But it would be a horrible thing for him to do that to Wardlow on the biggest night of this man's life. I also, frankly, don't see how smart it is for him to force the issue now or walk out now when he stands to make even more money by pitting the two companies against each other. If he burns a bridge with Tony Khan, he gets no offer from the AEW side if Tony just lets him walk. And I'm sure WWE, look, they're not going to pay him peanuts. They'll pay him well enough, but they may not see the need to pay him as well as they would otherwise have paid him if they know that there is no longer any competition from the AEW side. Because MJF is not going to Impact. MJF is not going to the NWA. He's not going to go over to Japan and work strong style. He's either going to be in WWE or he's going to be in AEW. He is not going anywhere else. He is not going to Ring of Honor. He is not going back to MLW. He is going to be on the biggest stage possible. Whether that's USA Network and Fox or TNT and TBS remains to be seen. Why burn a bridge on one side when you don't have to? And you can use that to make yourself even more money. That's one aspect of this I don't get. That doesn't seem to me like a very smart move, which tells me that there likely is more to this than just money. There's likely more to this than just the financial aspect that we don't know about. Now, I'm sure you guys are going to have questions about the MJF stuff. You can drop those super chats tonight after the pay-per-view. I'm going to be live. I'm sure we'll have a lot more to talk about when it comes to this. I will do my best to answer those questions. If the match happens, and I believe that it will, I hope it does. I'll get to the rest of my predictions in a few minutes, but I may as well do this one now. Wardlow against MJF has been the best built match and really the best built story on this entire show tonight. Tony Khan has booked this thing to perfection. MJF has been tormenting Wardlow ever since Revolution, and even longer than that, but especially since Revolution, when Wardlow refused to hand the Dynamite Diamond Ring to MJF for him to use against CM Punk. Wardlow has gotten over with the fans in the same way that Dave Bautista did before he broke away from Evolution. The fans have gravitated to him. They think he's cool. He's a badass. They want to support him. They want to see him powerbomb the shit out of people. It's very easy to get over when you just go around powerbombing people. That's how Sid got over all those years ago. But in the story, he asked out of his contract with MJF, and MJF not only refused, he sent him home because he was getting more over than MJF was. And when that didn't work, he put him in the ring with the Butcher. And then he put him in the ring with Lance Archer. And then he had a big surprise for him, and he put him in the ring with William Morrissey from Impact Wrestling. And when all of that didn't work, he finally agreed to give him the match that he wanted with himself. But on two conditions: that he take 10 lashes from MJF, which he did, and that he beat Sean Spears inside a steel cage with MJF as the special referee. And that is what Wardlow did on Wednesday. Now he's got his match, and the fans want to see violence. They want to see him murder MJF. Then and only then will Wardlow be a free man. But if he loses, Wardlow can never sign a contract with AEW. Now, I never would have added that stipulation because I think it gives away the finish. There is always the possibility that MJF wins, and their way around it is that Wardlow doesn't sign a contract with AEW. He signs a contract with Ring of Honor. And maybe they even make him the Ring of Honor World Champion, and then he can still technically appear on AEW television even though he's not under contract to them. There's no need for that. This is basic storytelling. The fans have been very patient. You give them the payoff that they have been waiting for. They have been waiting for MJF to get his comeuppance. That is what you give them tonight. Wardlow has said that he is going to set a record. He's going to set a world record for the most power bombs. He is going to power bomb MJF until he cannot physically power bomb him anymore. Wardlow is going to win this match, and they will close out this story the right way. But that is entirely dependent upon what MJF chooses to do. And in a way, it's kind of shitty, because what should have been the Wardlow story has now become the MJF story. It's no longer about Wardlow. It's all about what is MJF going to do. He has made this into a story all about himself, which also takes away from Wardlow. But there's only one correct outcome to this match if it goes down tonight. It was 3 years ago this week that I sat in the third row at the MGM Grand in Las Vegas for the very first pay-per-view, the very first show of any kind, to be hosted by this new startup promotion called AEW. And that was a very fun weekend, eating a stack of pancakes for breakfast with a shot of whiskey to wash it down. Breakfast of champions. Doing karaoke with Brian Zane. I finally got to meet Steven Larson, who couldn't be nicer. Matthew from Botchamania, Jack the Jobber. Met a lot of people that weekend. And then, of course, MJF showing up to the pre-show press conference in the front row between me and... He was sitting between me and JD, disguised as a Jewish rabbi, heckling people until Atlas Security carried him out. It was good times. 10 days earlier, AEW announced a deal with WarnerMedia for a television show that would bring pro wrestling back to TNT for the first time in almost 20 years. Without running a single show. A few months later, Warner signed them to a new agreement that paid them $175 million over 4 years and basically saved the company. When just 2 months later, the world shut down and AEW was no longer able to sell tickets to live events. Without that TV money, there would be no AEW today. And I had a blast that night watching Cody and Dustin go out and have the kind of match they always wanted to have in WWE at WrestleMania, which they never did. Watching the Young Bucks and the Lucha Bros tear it up, giving us a taste of what was to come with the tag team division in AEW. Watching Jon Moxley, less than a month after working his last WWE match, come through the crowd and lay out Chris Jericho, lay out Kenny Omega, lay out a referee. Moxley, Jericho, Cody, Dustin, the Bucks, Omega. These were all names that I knew before AEW was even a thing, but there were also a lot of other names, a lot of young talent I had never heard of or seen much of before. It was a nice mix. But the vibe in the building that night was something that you had to be there, I think, to really appreciate. You could feel that this was something big. Something was going on here. This was something we had not had since the death of WCW. Now, like I said on the stream on Wednesday, AEW is not perfect. Some of the cracks are starting to show as they grow and the roster expands. But wrestling is in a far better place with a second major promotion than it would be without one. AEW has achieved a lot in these 3 years, a lot more than others before them that have tried to compete. From their success on TV to putting 20,000 people in Arthur Ashe Stadium and outselling WWE on Long Island. I mean, WWE always had a lock on New York, as long as I've been a fan. But no more. Packing in the United Center now, not once but twice. You know, for tonight's show, AEW became the only company outside of WWE to do a $1 million gate in the U.S. for a show that sold out immediately, the same day that tickets went on sale. They broke their own record, which was for the Arthur Ashe show last year. I think they can make even more money by expanding their pay-per-view schedule from 4 shows a year to 5 or 6. I don't think they need one every month like WWE, but 5 or 6 I think would be a good number. It's like when WWE expanded and they added King of the Ring back in 93. They went from 4 to 5. And their roster was nowhere near the size of what AEW's roster is today. I think the size of the roster now being what it is and the fact that they were able to move as many tickets as they did for the Forbidden Door show only 4 weeks after this pay-per-view tonight shows that the AEW fans would be willing to pay for an extra 1 or 2 big events each year. You know, they have 3 years worth of content now just sitting in their archives begging for a streaming deal with someone. Next year, they're going to be negotiating for a new television rights deal at a time when live sports are commanding big bucks. If you're Tony Khan, you only hope they keep that same energy 18 months from now. The potential for them to grow even bigger is there. You look at what they've done in just the first 3 years, and you wonder, where might they be 3 years from now? Double or Nothing is back in Sin City for the first time in 3 years, with a stacked card highlighted by CM Punk getting his first crack at the AEW World Championship since coming to the company. I'm going to run through my predictions for the full card, 13 matches deep. But before I do, I want to tell you about the WrestleRumble.com Double or Nothing Pick'em Contest. Time is running out to enter. The cutoff time for entries is tonight at 8 p.m., right before the pay-per-view goes on the air. The winner of the contest gets $1,000 cash. All you need to do is answer a series of prop questions like, how long will the Punk and Hangman match be? Which wrestler will eat the pin or submission loss in the tag team title match? And how many tables will break during the 10-man tag? Go to WrestleRumble.com to enter, and you could end up $1,000 richer. Let's run through these predictions. We've got Hook and Danhausen on the buy-in pre-show. Hookhausen taking on Tony Nese and Smart Mark Sterling. The Hook and Danhausen act is over. There's no doubt about it, whether you like it or not. The people love it. And it is the perfect first match to send out there in front of that crowd. No real surprise here. Hook is not losing his first match on this show. It's not going to happen. But I see Danhausen getting the win. Maybe after Hook puts one of them out with the Red Rum, he sneaks in, gets the pin, probably on Mark Sterling. But Hook and Danhausen go over. On Rampage on Friday, we had two new matches added to an already stacked card. A card, frankly, that didn't need any more matches. We got two more of them. Darby Allin challenged Kyle O'Reilly to a match. Two men who came out losers in the Owen Hart tournament. O'Reilly was the one who took out Sting when Adam Cole wrapped a chair around Sting's ankle. And Kyle came off the top rope with a knee drop onto the chair. They even pulled Sting from the meet and greet that he was scheduled to do in Vegas this weekend and said that they would refund everybody's money. That meet and greet was sold out to the tune of $150 a pop. So either they are making a very strong commitment to kayfabe here, or maybe Sting really is hurt and they shot that angle to cover for another injury that he might be dealing with. Darby is out for revenge. That is the story here. That is why he wants this match. The upside here is with Darby, it's not with Kyle. I mean, Kyle is very good, but he's not the star here. Darby is the star. Darby lost to Jeff Hardy in the Owen. I would not beat him again. I think Darby gets the win. The other match added is a mixed trios match with the TNT champion Scorpio Sky, Ethan Page, and Paige Van Zandt making her pro wrestling in-ring debut, taking on Frankie Kazarian, Sammy Guevara, and Ty Conti. Ethan Page added the stipulation that if Kazarian, Guevara, and Conti lose this match, then Frankie and Sammy can never again challenge for the TNT title. And they also said that this issue has to end between them. It has to be over. From their lips to Tony Khan's ears, let it be so. I'm more interested in the crowd reaction to this than anything else. I mean, I'm also curious to see how Van Zandt looks, because I was a fan of her signing, and I think that she might have an aptitude for this, but nobody's actually seen her wrestle yet, so I'm kind of curious about that. But what I'm most interested in is how the crowd responds. You know, you throw in Paige, you throw in Van Zandt in there, and I have to specify which Paige I'm talking about. We have two of them in this match. We have three of them on this show. But with her making her debut in this match, I would think that might push them over the top as far as being the crowd favorites. It should be Lambert's team going over. But I think they give it to Kazarian, Sammy, and Ty. What do they open the main card with? That's the other question that I was wondering. Because, again, you got plenty of matches to choose from here. Only one can open the actual main portion of this pay-per-view. The trios match with Death Triangle against the House of Black. That is what I would open the pay-per-view portion with. That opening match, it sets the tone for the entire show. Remember they had that great opening match? I think it was Full Gear between MJF and Darby Allin. It sets the entire tone for the night. And I think that this match, if you look back to Revolution, House of Black had a fantastic match with Penta, Pac, and Eric Redbeard on that Revolution pre-show. Here, they're substituting Rey Fénix for Eric Redbeard, which, all due respect to Redbeard, who I thought was great in that match, he ain't no Rey Fénix. This is quite the upgrade. And I've talked about my disappointment in how little we actually get to see the House of Black, specifically Malakai Black, on these shows. They have not had much to really sink their teeth into. The feud with the Varsity Blondes did nobody any favors. All the stuff with Julia Hart and all that, it just was a complete waste as far as what these guys, I think, should be doing. The pending trios titles are tailor-made for either of these teams, but we still have no idea when Tony Khan plans to introduce them. I wouldn't beat the House of Black yet. I think they go over here and I would book them in a program soon with the Blackpool Combat Club. So we also, out of that, get some singles matches. Malakai against Moxley, Danielson against Buddy Matthews. A lot of great potential there. That's where I'd like to see them go. But as far as this match goes, it's a win for the House of Black. Samoa Joe, one-on-one with Adam Cole for the first time ever in the finals of the Owen Hart Foundation tournament. When Joe debuted at Supercard of Honor and joined Tony Khan in the post-show scrum, he made it very clear he wanted to be in the Owen. When they said, "What? Why are you here? What are your goals here? What does Samoa Joe want to do other than dominate in Ring of Honor?" It was one of the first things he said. He wants to be in the Owen Hart tournament. He got his wish, and he has made it all the way to the finals, but I think that's as good as it gets for Samoa Joe in this tournament, and I think that's due to interference from Jay Lethal, Sanjay Dutt, and Satnam Singh. Joe is in the middle of feuding with them. I think they factor into this. Adam Cole is going to win the Owen. And, you know, the other night, I think I was a little harsh on this tournament when I said that there really haven't been any memorable matches up to this point. There's been some really short ones, but there's been nothing that people are really going to remember. But on the men's side, that's not true. On the men's side, I did very much enjoy Dax against Cash. And you don't have to like the match between Jeff Hardy and Darby Allin. And there was a lot to hate about what they did in that match. You don't even have to be a fan of that match to admit that you are damn sure going to remember all the crazy shit they did to each other in that match. For better or worse, we're going to remember that match for a long time. So there have been some memorable moments. I think it's a win for Adam Cole. Dr. Britt Baker, DMD, in the Owen Hart Foundation Tournament Finals, goes up against Ruby Soho, who beat Chris Statlander to advance on Rampage Friday night. This is one of three women's matches on this 13-match card. I was upset that Statlander lost on Friday. It's not often I'm watching these matches on these shows and I get upset about, you know, certain someone going over, at least maybe not with AEW so much as WWE. But that bothered me. And clearly it bothered the crowd as well in Vegas. They booed Ruby Soho after the match. Not because they hate Ruby Soho, but because they really wanted to see Chris Statlander go over. To the point where Ruby in her post-match promo had to stop and acknowledge the reaction from the fans because they were booing. She had to say, "Okay, guys, I get it. I get it. I like Chris too, but this is my moment." But now it sets up a rematch from last year's Grand Slam show at Arthur Ashe Stadium, where Britt Baker retained her title over Ruby Soho. A few days ago, I said I didn't think Adam Cole and Britt Baker would both win the Owens. Cole, yes. Britt, I figured she was going to go over all the way to the finals and then lose to whoever the babyface was. But that was before Ruby Soho won. I have had a change of heart. I think Britt Baker is going to win this. And I think we end up with Cole and Baker as basically the prom king and queen of AEW with their respective Owen belts. That's the rumor anyway, that the winners are going to be presented with a belt, if not a belt and a trophy. A black belt on the men's side, a pink belt on the women's side. We'll see. And Tony Khan says he has a whole bunch of belts that he's hiding, apparently, waiting to debut. The Owen belts, the Trios belts, who knows what other belts he might have in storage. But I think that's what we end up with. I think that we have Cole go over on the men's side, and I think Britt Baker goes over on the women's side, even though she really doesn't need it. But I just don't see Ruby Soho going all the way. If she does, great. You know, again, she lost to Britt Baker once before. It'd be nice to see her get her revenge and, you know, finally win something here in AEW. But I don't know. I don't feel like that's going to happen here. We have Jade Cargill against Anna Jay for the TBS Championship. Jade remains undefeated coming into this match. 31-0. She will be 32-0 when this is over. And she retains her title. Because I think the end game, if it isn't, it should be. I think the end game is her and Chris Statlander. Even though Statlander lost to Ruby in the tournament, I think she could be the one to hand Jade her first defeat and take that championship. She would be my choice. It will not be Anna Jay, though. The Young Bucks take on the Hardys. Elite against Delete is how they're branding this match. I loved the Hardy cosplay from the Bucks on Rampage and the cameo from Gangrel. I totally forgot that the Hardys and Gangrel were the new brood for a while. I always remember the brood, but the new brood, it's like the new Coke. You know, it didn't last very long. So I had totally forgotten about that. It was good to see Gangrel. I felt bad for him last year when Edge did the brood entrance at SummerSlam at Allegiant Stadium, and it looked great, but it cost Gangrel a spot on Dynamite, because Tony Khan was planning to fly him into the show that same week to do the old brood-like entrance, and that had been in the works for a while. So it wasn't like, well, they saw, you know, WWE do it and they wanted to do it. Just the opposite. When they saw WWE do it, it scuttled all of their plans. They were going to fly him into Dynamite the day before. Gangrel gets the phone call. Hey, you know what? The plan is off. The plan is off. So at least he got his moment. But watching him walk to the ring was painful. His knees looked shot. But then later on, when he got in the ring and he got a little physical and he got to deliver that implant DDT after the Bucks won their match, he looked good. You know, he got some good height on it. So it's not like he can't move around. Just to watch him walk, though, clearly he's having some knee issues. But the Bucks turned on him at the end of that segment, and then that led to the Hardys coming out to make the save. They have not dedicated a lot of television time to set things up between these two teams. There is a history there. These two teams met at the ROH Supercard of Honor show in 2017 in a ladder match for the Ring of Honor Tag Team titles. That was the night before the Hardys returned to WWE at WrestleMania in Orlando. The Bucks won that match. I think Matt and Jeff pick up the win here to set up the eventual rubber match to break the tie. And I think the Hardys need to win that one as well, because the bigger story here, as beat up as Matt and Jeff might be, and there are some weeks where both of them look, I mean, old and slow, and then there's other weeks where there's a little more pep in their step. But clearly, you know, they're older, they're more beat up. That's what happens, especially when you work that kind of style. Even despite that, the story is their quest to become the AEW Tag Team Champions, the only pair of tag team belts left that they have not won. This is the final Hardy run together. They have said the same thing. This is the last run, the last hurrah for the Hardy Boys. They need to beat the Bucks to make that story work, as they continue to work their way through that division. So the Hardys win. Jungle Boy and Luchasaurus, speaking of the tag team titles, they defend their AEW tag team titles against Team Taz, Ricky Starks and Powerhouse Hobbs, and the team of Keith Lee and Swerve Strickland. On Dynamite, they gave us a preview of this with Jungle Boy, Ricky Starks, and Swerve in a triple threat match. There will be a lot of insanity. There will be a lot of dives. I know I'm really going out on a limb by predicting that for an AEW show, but there's going to be a lot of dives. Jurassic Express, they have held the titles for almost 5 months. They successfully defended them against Red Dragon and the Young Bucks at Revolution in another three-way match. I don't see lightning striking twice. when this is over, Keith Lee and Swerve Strickland will be the new AEW Tag Team Champions. I don't think Starks and Hobbs need it. And Starks already has the FTW title anyway. I'll be watching to see what, if any, role Christian Cage plays in the finish, because I think the split is coming soon with him and Jurassic Express, and I think he should be the one going heel and then wrestling Jungle Boy. I think he would be a great person for Jungle Boy to work against, and it would get Christian back in the ring because he hasn't done much lately. We haven't seen too much of Christian. And he's not getting any younger either. Who knows how many more great matches he's got left in him every year that goes by. Him and Jungle Boy, I think, would be a lot of fun to watch. To get there, though, there has to be a fracture within the team, and we might just see the start of that here at the pay-per-view. But I think Keith Lee and Swerve Strickland are going to pick up the gold, and they're going to be your new champions. We have Anarchy in the Arena, or as Excalibur called it on Friday night. I think he said the... how did he say it? They're calling the match Anarchy in the Arena. I think he did the inverse, and he called it Arena in the Anarchy or something. This poor guy, he doesn't know what he's saying anymore. He talks so fast sometimes, I don't even think he knows what he's saying. We have the Jericho Appreciation Society against Jon Moxley, Brian Danielson, Eddie Kingston, Santana, and Ortiz. This has been one of the few things I have not really enjoyed on these shows. Second only to the TNT title stuff. The segments have been very hit or miss, mostly miss. But I do think the Jericho faction is winning this, which then sets things up for the second ever Blood and Guts match on a special episode of Dynamite sometime after the Forbidden Door show. I would think they want to hold off until after Forbidden Door. So probably early July, I could see them doing a second Blood and Guts show, and these would be the teams. And that'll be where the babyfaces get their big win. I don't think it happens on this show. I think Jericho's team goes over. Thunder Rosa defends her AEW Women's Championship against Serena Deeb. Rosa won the title from Britt Baker on the St. Patrick's Day Slam episode of Dynamite in her hometown, inside a steel cage. Since then, she has successfully defended her title against Nyla Rose at Battle of the Belts 2. And there hasn't been much else to speak of. Serena Deeb is the perfect opponent for her, but I'm left hoping that the destination is far better than the trip there. Their segments leading up to this have been very underwhelming. Rosa had a nice little promo on Wednesday, showed a lot of fire and a lot of passion, and, you know, she didn't have the makeup on. She said, this is the real me, and, you know, she's out to prove something. She's talked in the past about how when she was, you know, early in her career, she would travel around in California watching Serena Deeb wrestle, so she's always looked up to her and respected her. And Deeb, of course, the story is that she feels disrespected, and that's the basic story here. But Thunder Rosa thinks she's the best wrestler on the roster. She's tired of being, Serena Deeb, rather, thinks that she's the best. She's tired of being disrespected by everybody. She's always been the good little soldier. She got breast implants to impress all the old men in charge at WWE. Then she willingly shaved her head to join the Straight Edge Society. She's always done what other people wanted her to do, or what she thought other people wanted her to do. Now she's going to do something for herself. She's never gotten her just due at Double or Nothing. She can finally win a world championship. That's the basic story. But Thunder Rosa is not dropping that title 2 months after winning it. Not going to happen. And as lackluster as her run has been so far, and I don't blame her for that. I blame the booking for that. I don't blame Thunder Rosa for that. She deserves better. And she's going to retain her championship here and go on. Hopefully whatever she ends up in next will be more exciting than the build-up to this match. The match itself, though, should be very good. You know, they give them some time. Deeb is a pro. We know Thunder Rose is very good. I think the match itself will end up being very good. And in our main event, Hangman Adam Page puts the AEW world title on the line against CM Punk. Punk is looking to hold his first title in wrestling in 9 years. A lot of people shit on Page's run as the champion. They call him weak. He's had some great matches, including the match with Omega at Full Gear when he won the title. In the ring, he has been anything but weak. When that bell rings and you expect the champion to go out there and deliver on the big stage, I believe he's done that. But those people are right in that Hangman as champion doesn't feel like the biggest star in the company. He doesn't feel like as big of a deal as Jon Moxley was or Kenny Omega. It's not just about the in-ring stuff. His promos, I think, have improved recently. He's done some better promo work than I've seen from him. The last few shows, we've seen an angrier Hangman. On Wednesday, he was livid talking about Punk. Even Punk couldn't understand why he was so mad. It's like, why are you mad, bro? What's going on? He said, this isn't personal, it's just business. Why so serious? To Paige, it's meant to feel personal. And why? I don't think he did a great job of articulating this, but the idea is that he sees through CM Punk. He thinks that he is being disingenuous. He's not here to help other people. He's in it for himself. Eddie Kingston called attention to the same thing in his feud with CM Punk in some of their promos and their past together on the indie scene, not liking Punk. Punk hasn't done or said anything on AEW television, though, that would lead the viewer to believe that. There's been no hints of anything. But Paige believes it to be true. He's not trying to beat CM Punk. He says he's trying to save AEW from Punk. It's like the storyline in TNA with Sting and Hogan. That's what it reminds me of. When Hogan and Bischoff came in, Sting was acting like the bad guy. He was being treated like the heel. That was what led to the Joker Sting stuff. But really, he was trying to warn people. He was trying to show people Hogan's true colors. And eventually, he was proven right. But at first, it looked just the opposite. What is Sting doing? Now, maybe Punk wins and it drives Hangman over the edge and he ends up going heel. Or maybe Punk wins and he proves Hangman right and Punk ends up as the heel. I think there's less of a chance of that happening. I do think there's money in a CM Punk heel turn. Now is not the right time for it. Not just with the Forbidden Door in Chicago next month, but because I still feel that MJF is going to be the one to take that belt from Punk. And Punk has to still be a babyface for that to work. Hangman might let his emotions get the better of him. And I predict that CM Punk will walk out of Las Vegas the new AEW World Champion. I also don't think that this is the end of things with these two. This cannot be the end of things between CM Punk and Hangman Page. This feels like the beginning of their story. This does not feel like the end. But I do think Punk is walking out with that belt. So I'm going to be live on YouTube as soon as the show is over for the full review. It's going to be a late one, as all of these AEW pay-per-views are. Remember, they only do four of them each year. So they try to squeeze as much into these as humanly possible. In a very embarrassing move, WWE announced this week that the Money in the Bank pay-per-view on July 2nd, which was set for Allegiant Stadium in Las Vegas, the site of last year's SummerSlam, and the first Money in the Bank to ever be held inside of a stadium, will no longer be held inside of a stadium, and instead it is being moved to the smaller MGM Grand Garden Arena, the same building AEW ran for its first Double or Nothing show 3 years ago. Tony Khan has been having some fun with this. He's probably not having too much fun right now with this whole MJF situation, but he was having fun on Friday, saying that he and his father had dinner with Dana White on Thursday, and he was the one who broke the news to Dana about WWE moving from Allegiant to MGM. He called it a genius move, trying to take on Dana and the UFC in Vegas during International Fight Week. That was a very stupid thing for them to do. He's not wrong. For them to run the same night that UFC is running, in the same city, UFC 276 is at the T-Mobile Arena that night. And because UFC is running T-Mobile, WWE couldn't even move the show there. They had to settle for MGM, which is the smaller of the two buildings. And when a fan tweeted at Tony and said, "Still sold 17,000 tickets, someone is afraid of competing," Khan wrote back, "Good plan, selling 17,000 seats to a 12,000-seat arena." You know, sometimes he doesn't make the best use of social media sometimes, but this is not one of those times. I was thoroughly entertained by Tony the Troll. WWE is offering fans who bought tickets to the stadium refunds and a special password for the presale for the new arena, which is taking place on June 1st. But the password is already out for everyone. I mean, it's not hard to find. It's a mess because they had already sold more tickets for the stadium show than they have available seats in the new building. And people who already paid for flights and hotels, most of them are probably fine if they're still planning on going. But if for some reason they're not going to be going to the show anymore, they have to try to get their money back now. Maybe someone who paid for great seats at Allegiant gets shut out at the new building and decides, you know what, I don't want to go. Or if they're going as a family, maybe this time they can't get four or five or six seats together like they could at the stadium, which is bigger. Meltzer says the decision was actually made 2 weeks ago to make the move, but for whatever reason, they continue to advertise the show for Allegiant Stadium. It's all very strange to me because they already had 17 or 18,000 tickets for the show sold. They weren't opening up the entire stadium because they had no chance of selling out the entire stadium. I don't even think they sold out the entire stadium for SummerSlam. You weren't going to sell it out for Money in the Bank. So they were expecting maybe around 30,000 in a building that can fit at least double that. And 30,000 is still a great number. 25,000 is still a very good number. A month out, I don't know if they would have gotten to 30. Evidently, they felt they weren't going to, because why move the show? This is supposed to be part of Nick Khan's plan to run more stadium shows so they can fit more people into the building. So instead of running an NBA building with, let's say, 15,000 people, you know, capacity with the stage and everything, they could run a stadium and get 25,000. Instead of selling 16,000 tickets, they could sell 28,000 or 30,000 tickets. And probably still make it look pretty good on TV and not look too empty. So again, why the change? It sounds to me like Vince McMahon was worried that it wasn't going to look good on TV because they couldn't sell enough tickets. You know, they just sold out the Allstate Arena in Chicago this week for Hell in a Cell, which is coming up next month. So I can't sit here and tell you the product is ice cold right now. In some places, they're doing very well, but the product is not anywhere near as hot as it once was. There are some people who want you to believe that wrestling as a whole and WWE, because they make billions and billions of dollars, oh, it's so hot, it's such a hot product. No, it's not. No, it's not. It is not nearly as hot and as popular as it was many years ago when they weren't making as much money as they're making now, because they don't just make money off tickets. That used to be their bread and butter. They would make money on tickets, they would make money on pay-per-views, but they got their guaranteed money. There's so many different ways this company makes money, whether it's the TV contracts, whether it's merch, whether it's streaming, whatever it might be. But, you know, there's this illusion in some circles that this company, because of how much money they make, the product is so hot, it's a white-hot product. No, it's not. And this is proof positive of that. Because there was a period of time that they could have packed in Allegiant Stadium for a show like Money in the Bank. And when I say packed, even if they don't sell it out, they could get 30, 35, 40,000 people in there. With the product now, have you watched Raw or SmackDown? You think that they're going to pack in 30,000, 40,000 people in Allegiant Stadium for a Money in the Bank show? I mean, when I mentioned the Nick Khan stuff a few weeks ago and what his plans were, I thought it was smart. You know, I understood why he would, you know, want to do it. But to do an about-face like this after they already sold tickets and they've been running commercials with Cody Rhodes standing in the middle of Allegiant Stadium is embarrassing. He was standing in the middle of an empty stadium. That's where he might still be there. And now, whatever plans they had for Roman Reigns and Brock Lesnar on the show and possibly Ronda Rousey might be out the window because in the new poster for the show, I know Roman was on the old poster. I don't know if Brock was, but he was due back for that show. On the new poster, all three of them are nowhere to be found. On the new poster, all three of them are gone. Roman has been replaced by Cody Rhodes, just like what happened with Hell in a Cell. And at Hell in a Cell, Roman Reigns is not on that show. So did they take all three of them off Money in the Bank because it's no longer a stadium show? You know, why did they think running Money in the Bank in a stadium was a good idea? If it boils down to ticket sales, again, I cannot stress this enough. The WWE product is not hot enough to run three stadium shows in the span of 2 months. They're going to do it anyway. But when you do it, this is the kind of problem that you run into. Remember, SummerSlam at the end of July is at Nissan Stadium in Nashville. Clash at the Castle is at Principality Stadium in Cardiff on Labor Day weekend. They've got 22,000 tickets out for SummerSlam so far, with 2 months left to go. They're already running four for the price of three discounts locally. So they're already discounting tickets to try to get more people into the stadium. Nissan Stadium fits up to 69,000 people. Nissan is not 69ing WWE. They're not getting that many people in there. They're not even going to get close to that number in that building. Are they going to move that too? You know, Nick Khan wants to run even more stadium shows in 2023. Yeah, good luck with that. I mean, they could always claim there was a bomb threat made on the show like they did with WrestleMania 7. I still love that story. They booked the LA Memorial Coliseum, which could have fit close to 100,000 people. They booked that a year out for WrestleMania 7. For the all-American hero, Hulk Hogan, against the evil Iraqi sympathizer, Sergeant Slaughter. Thinking that they would sell it out or come close to selling it out. The only thing that bombed were their ticket sales. So they moved it. And they had 20,000 people in the building. They need a good, evil, heel foreigner that they can blame this on. Some other news and notes. The only update on the Sasha Banks and Naomi situation, per this week's Observer, is that their indefinite suspensions are without pay. We didn't know if they were still being paid or not. They are not being paid. And because their merch was also pulled from WWE Shop, they're also no longer making any money off that. Beyond that, the situation hasn't changed. You know, for legal reasons, they're still not talking. There's no indication they plan on coming back anytime soon or that WWE would even want them back. We still don't know if the company froze their contracts or not. I don't know why they wouldn't. They've done it with other people who have not, you know, committed such an egregious crime as what these two do. I'm sure Vince McMahon looks at this as just the worst of all sins, so I have no idea why they wouldn't freeze their contracts. Naomi was said to have a couple of months left on her deal. She was in the middle of negotiating a new one. Sasha Banks' deal is also said to be up soon, possibly in the next couple of months. But if WWE wants to play hardball, they could freeze them until they're ready to come back. If they freeze them, but choose to keep them suspended, that opens up a whole can of worms, because can they legally do that? For how long can they legally do that? They can't just tie them up for the rest of their lives. You know, but WWE can say, hey, they breached their deals, which they did when they walked out, and again, I support their decision to walk out, but there was always going to be a price to pay for doing that, and now they're paying that price. Per PW Insider, Jeff Jarrett is back in WWE, and he's got himself a nice, cushy, high-level executive position to go along with his big return. He will be working on the live events end of things in what Mike Johnson says will be the position of Senior Vice President of Live Events. And he officially starts the new gig this week. You know, Jarrett came back to WWE 3 years ago as a producer before shifting over to the creative team and then over to a role in the live events department. But when COVID hit and there were no more live events, the two sides quietly parted ways. And now that they're back running live shows again, they brought back Double J. That's JEFFJARRET. Double J, Jeff Jarrett, back in WWE. I guess Effie won't be getting his win back over Jarrett in GCW anytime soon. Jarrett, by the way, is Steve Austin's next guest on the Broken Skull Sessions this Friday. The same week he happens to start his new gig. How about that synergy? I've watched every Broken Skull Sessions that Steve Austin has done. It is my favorite of all of the original shows on the network. This will be one of the more interesting ones, if only because of the history between these two and the history of Austin not wanting to work with Jarrett in the Attitude Era when Jarrett came in from WCW. Bruce Pritchard has said the reason that Austin didn't want to work with Jeff was because he didn't think he was over enough to work with him. Which he wasn't. Austin was right. But the story has always been, and Jarrett himself has confirmed that he did this, he doesn't deny it, that when Austin worked for Jeff's father, many years ago in the USWA, one day Austin was in the back and he was staring at how low his paycheck was. And here comes Jeff, the promoter's son, and he comes over and he slaps Austin on the shoulder or the back or whatever it was. And he says, "Keep staring at it, boy. It ain't going to make it any bigger." And Jarrett on the podcast that he does with Conrad says that he remembers doing it. But he said he did that to everybody, not just Steve Austin. He said his paycheck, he claims his paychecks were exactly what everybody else's were. He said they got $40. It was in Evansville, Indiana. So I'm sure this will come up during the episode. It has to. It has to come up during this episode. And we'll get to hear it from Austin's point of view, exactly what it was. Was it the incident? We call it incident. But what was it, the incident? Was it something else? Was it just that he didn't think Jarrett was on his level? He wasn't. The fact is, Jeff Jarrett was not over enough at that time to be working a full program with Steve Austin. Could they have done a television match? Sure. And Austin would have stunned him and pinned him, and that would have been it. But to work a program when Austin was already on the ascent at that point in time? No. Absolutely not. It's like The Rock working with Billy Gunn at SummerSlam. You know, they were trying to, I get they were trying to get Billy over. He won King of the Ring that year, but it was a failure. And it was beneath The Rock to be in a match with Mr. Ass at WrestleMania. So anyway, that would be even worse. If they put Billy Gunn in the ring with The Rock at WrestleMania, that would be booking malpractice. But that was SummerSlam back in 99. And I think back to that. Of course, the only thing I remember about that match is the call of Jim Ross on commentary talking about how The Rock just shoved Billy Gunn's face in that large woman's ass. It's the only thing I remember about that match. So anyway, that airs on Friday. I will definitely be watching that. And again, they're all great. All the episodes are great. Some are more interesting than others, you know, but he's done them with, I mean, the last few that he's done, you know, even the Bully Ray one was very good. And he's interviewed Lita and he's had Sasha Banks on the show. You know, obviously a couple of parts with The Undertaker. Cody Rhodes was on the one before this. They're all great. It is the best show on the network. In a press conference on Friday, Takaki Kidani, the founder of Bushiroad, the parent company of both New Japan Pro Wrestling and Stardom, and New Japan president Takami Obari, apologized to Kota Ibushi and announced that he would not be released from his contract following his recent social media posts, which threatened to expose Obari's lies and sexually harassing bosses and kind of alluded to potential Yakuza involvement with New Japan, or at least it was sort of implied, but there were no specifics given. This is Obari's full statement. Because I went into this in detail a few weeks ago, I do want to read the entire statement. I'll try to get through this quickly, but this is his full statement on the timeline of events and where things currently stand with Ibushi, who also later on, you know, when he went on that Twitter tirade or that tweet storm, he tweeted later on that his mother attempted to commit suicide after all of this came out, which is awful. You know, and Ibushi just celebrated his 40th birthday. I think it was around that time that apparently his mother tried to kill herself. Thankfully, she wasn't successful, but she did get hurt. But this was the full statement from the New Japan president. "Today, on behalf of New Japan Pro Wrestling, I would like to address recent claims made by Kota Ibushi. Starting May 10th, Kota Ibushi began releasing statements critical of certain members of New Japan staff on Twitter. Firstly, I would like to deeply apologize for the concern that these comments caused amongst the fans and personnel. The statement posted on Twitter included screenshots of a text conversation with a member of staff that included a threat that Ibushi's contract would be terminated. On investigation, we ascertained from the individual concerned that these screenshots were indeed genuine. I would now like to take a moment to explain the series of events that led up to the aforementioned posts to the extent of our current understanding. Kota Ibushi is a wrestler exclusively contracted to New Japan Pro Wrestling As such, it is understood that in order to devote full attention to New Japan matches and associated events, he is required to inform and receive express permission from New Japan before outside appearances. On March 4th, in breach of the terms of his contract, Mr. Ibushi made an appearance for, seconding wrestlers at a Just Tap Out event. The aforementioned official is responsible for contacting various wrestlers contracted to New Japan, but also has a long personal history with Mr. Ibushi that extends far before him becoming an exclusively contracted talent. The official contacted Mr. Ibushi in the belief that his actions in breach of his contract were taken deliberately to persuade New Japan to terminate its agreement with him. Perceiving this as a betrayal of a personal trust established over a number of years, his messages were sent in an emotional state as a result. When I myself learned of Mr. Ibushi's appearance in a different promotion, I requested a full status report from the official. Therefore, it is possible that the official's contact with Mr. Ibushi also involved a desire to find out the exact particulars of the situation to relay to myself. In relaying this report, the official told me that he thought Mr. Ibushi wanted to leave New Japan. Not wanting to lose the services of Kota Ibushi in such a manner, and wanting to find out his true mental state and opinions of this matter, I arranged a meeting with him on his personal, or at his personal, training facility on March 31st. In my brief meeting with Mr. Ibushi, we chatted while we conducted some light exercise. As we moved on the mat and participated in some jump training, I'm just trying to picture this in my head now, I was amazed at his superhuman physical abilities. Yet Ibushi confided that he found recovery from his 2021 shoulder injury was taking longer than he expected, and that his range of motion was far from ideal. After our conversation, Mr. Ibushi took me by car to a restaurant where we continued our conversation. Our conversation was amicable, and Mr. Ibushi explained to me that he had been invited to Just Tap Out by its manager, Taka Michinoku. He also explained that while he was in the dressing room, he made an impulsive decision on his own accord to head to ringside and second the wrestlers. After receiving Mr. Ibushi's explanation, I reprimanded him, reminding him that this was a breach of his contract, as well as a breach of licensing agreements that we hold with other companies. Mr. Ibushi sincerely apologized for his actions. His penalty for his breach was limited to a reprimand, as it was clear there was no intention to breach the terms of his contract, nor did he believe a breach had taken place, because he had not participated in a match. At the point of our meeting, I did not know the exact wording or particulars of Mr. Ibushi's text conversation with the official, and as a result did not offer a proper apology for the content of the conversation. Several weeks later, on May 10th, screenshots of the conversation were made public. I have since learned that those tweets were made when Mr. Ibushi was acting in a state of concern for his mother with mental distress being caused by this situation. Mr. Ibushi told me that after being contacted by his mother on May 8th and discussing the details of his situation with her, she attempted suicide on May 9th and suffered a broken bone in her back as a result. After the first series of Mr. Ibushi's tweets were posted, a meeting was held on May 10th, including our company's legal staff, in order to understand the particulars of the situation and to determine the best possible course of action for both New Japan and Mr. Ibushi. We determined the best course of action would be to directly meet with him to formally apologize and hear one another's opinions before making a public announcement should one be deemed necessary. As a result, there have been no formal announcements from the company on this matter until now. However, yesterday, myself and the company owner, Mr. Kidani, were able to meet with Mr. Ibushi and discuss this statement to you here as well as our opinions on the matter. Before proceeding, I would like once again to sincerely apologize to fans for the concern caused by this series of events. I would now like to relay the company's stance on the situation. Mr. Ibushi's actions in attending an outside event without proper procedure as well as publicly disclosing internal affairs were actions in breach of his contract, and after consideration of the particulars I have previously mentioned, an appropriate penalty for Mr. Ibushi will be determined. However, the words of the official in this text conversation were inexcusable, especially in their direction to a wrestler who risks his life in order to fulfill his role as a professional. It is this mindset that directly led to Mr. Ibushi posting his critical tweets about the company. For the thoughtless content of these messages, we fully and unreservedly apologize to Mr. Ibushi. Despite the official's lengthy relationship with him, the lack of consideration shown to him, and by extension, our wrestlers at large, should also be met with an appropriate penalty. And here in the final paragraph here, he talks about how it is his priority, must be to take care of his mother. He's talking about Ibushi now, that his priority should be taking care of his mom as well as fully recovering from his injury. And it should go without saying that he will remain under contract for as long as that process takes. Mr. Ibushi receives so much support from all over the world. While it might be difficult for him to perform in the ring, I sincerely hope that he can continue to contribute outside of it at signings, talk shows, and this is my personal wish, to assist in the operations of Stardom. I continue to hold him in the highest regard, and if he ever again feels he wants to move away from New Japan, I hope we can have a full and frank exchange of ideas. It is my opinion that his contributions to this company and the world of wrestling have been innumerable. So, New Japan doesn't want to lose Kota Ibushi, even after he set fire to that bridge. They're trying their best to put those flames out. They recognize how big of a star he is for them. You know, if this was somebody lower on the totem pole, I doubt after what he said they would even be given the same kind of latitude. There wouldn't even be a full statement like this. Later in the press conference, they said Ibushi will probably see a reduction in his salary for breaching his contract, and that the Kikuchi guy, that's the official that he kept referring to, might be moved to a different position in the company. But between his injury that still hasn't fully healed and the situation with his mom, you know, Ibushi has more important things to tend to right now than getting back in the ring. Here's some good news, though. Obari talked about the possible end to not allowing crowds in Japan to cheer and boo as part of the COVID restrictions in that country. They've only been allowed to clap. This has been going on now for, I think, over a year. Kevin Kelly also addressed this on social media. He said the change could be coming soon. DDT Pro has already announced cheering and booing will be allowed on their July 7th show, and seats are going to be spread apart. This is what Bryan Danielson has said he was waiting for before he works any matches in Japan. He wants the crowds to be able to react. He wants the crowds to be able to cheer and boo. So it looks like we're getting very close to that happening. I also have an update on former TNA announcer Don West, and it absolutely sucks. This breaks my heart. Don reached out to Mike Johnson, a PW Insider, with an update on his health. I mentioned on the podcast last June, so about a year ago now, that Don was diagnosed with brain lymphoma. 3 months later, he announced that he was in remission, but then in January of this year, he announced that the cancer had returned. And the latest update is that his brain tumor has grown to twice the size that it had been. He was hoping to undergo a stem cell treatment, but in light of the tumor growing, his doctors have had to cancel the stem cell treatment, and he's scheduled to start a new, different kind of treatment this week. I hate hearing this. This sucks. From all accounts, and I've met him a couple of times myself, but from all accounts, he's, you know, the nicest guy, and obviously he's always full of energy. I mean, this guy could sell hairspray to Stone Cold. I mean, that's how good he is, or was at his job when he was still doing that. I hope he can beat this. You know, Hacksaw Jim Duggan is also battling cancer for, I believe this would be the third time. He had kidney cancer many years ago when he was in WCW. And late last year, he announced that he had prostate cancer. And now his cancer, I think they took his whole prostate out, but now apparently his cancer is back and he's currently undergoing treatment. I hate cancer so very much. Scott D'Amore from Impact Wrestling, got to give him a shout out. He announced this morning that he will match 100% of every donation sent to Don's GoFundMe campaign now through Friday, which is a very cool thing of him to do. Go to the GoFundMe website. You can search for the campaign. It's titled Join the Don West Tag Team Against Lymphoma for anybody who wants to make a donation. Raw on Monday night was a fucking bore. Someone needs to Photoshop an actual boar with a Raw logo over its face. We'll make it the official mascot of the show. Not that SmackDown was much better. I did like seeing a different side of Matt Riddle at the start of the show. It looked like the start of a push for him in preparation for a match against Roman Reigns, which was rumored to be the plan for Money in the Bank, but who knows if Roman's even going to be on the show now. And on Friday night, they put Riddle together with Shinsuke Nakamura as a new tag team to go after the Usos. The two of them share a common enemy in the Bloodline. Between his opening promo and the match that followed on Monday, they dedicated the first 40 minutes of that show to Matt Riddle. Randy Orton was not on the show. Riddle said Randy's back was giving him a lot of problems, that he could barely walk before their unification match with the Usos, but he wanted to go through with it because he knew how much it meant to him and the fans. I believe Randy is fine. They're just keeping him out. I think the plan would be Riddle gets Roman first, and then when that is exhausted, Randy comes back, and that might be the SummerSlam main event. But Riddle showed real emotion here. His eyes were all red, and not from the weed. He was getting emotional talking about Randy. He told him that he loved him. He called Roman Reigns trash for getting involved in their match with the Usos. He said he would get his revenge on the entire Bloodline. Because we're so used to seeing goofy Riddle, you know, to see him on the verge of tears like that was kind of jarring. That led into a six-man tag match where Riddle tagged with the Street Profits to beat Sami Zayn and the Usos, who left Zayn for dead at the finish, and he took the RKO from Riddle for the loss. You might ask yourself, you know, isn't Sami Zayn on SmackDown? What is he doing on Raw? And Riddle is on Raw, as is Kevin Owens, so why were they both on SmackDown this week? Because there is no brand split. I finally realized this week. There's no point in complaining anymore about a brand split because there is no brand split. The brand split no longer exists. They can say that there's a brand split, but what WWE has basically done is they have quietly abandoned the brand split. It has been that way for a while now. They still have their brand-specific women's champions, but this is not a real brand split. It's like being half pregnant. There is no such thing. You cannot be half pregnant. You're either pregnant or you're not. You cannot be half pregnant. Clearly, they are not. So there is no brand split anymore. We had two segments involving Lashley, MVP, and Omos, neither of which were very good. Lashley wanted MVP in a singles match, which he came back out for in the third hour of this show. If Lashley won, he would get to pick the stipulation for the third match that nobody asked for between him and Omos at Hell in a Cell. Otherwise, MVP would pick the stip. After some interference from Omos, Lashley couldn't make it back into the ring before the 10 count, so he got counted out. MVP gets to pick the stipulation, which he announced after the show on Raw Talk will be a handicap match with him and Omos both taking on Lashley at the same time. Oh boy! The always exciting handicap match. I can hardly contain my excitement. We got more of the same from the Judgment Day this week, with Damian Priest giving credit to Edge for setting he and Rhea Ripley free. Freeing them to do what? He didn't say. Rhea just joined, but Priest has been with Edge since WrestleMania. He hasn't done anything yet. Edge healed on the fans and called them all sheep again. That's become his new go-to line. Then he teased different potential fourth members of the group, and he name-dropped Tommaso Ciampa, Corey Graves, Alexa Bliss, Drew McIntyre, Liv Morgan, Finn Balor, or even AJ Styles as a possible new member of their group. He called Ciampa by his first name. 10 lashes for him. Where's MJF when you need him? That's what Tony Khan was asking yesterday. Evidently, he's at the casino. Well, one of the problems, I think, is that there is no real mission. I know Priest referenced the mission statement from Edge the week before, but the mission should be winning championships. But the Bloodline has all the top titles right now. There's already another top heel faction that has all of the gold and the silver. Right? The U.S. title is held by another heel in Austin Theory. Rhea Ripley looks to be the only member of this group that might actually be wearing gold in the next few months if she goes to SummerSlam, like I said she should, and beats Bianca Belair. Priest and Ripley did pick up the win over Styles and Liv Morgan. They had a mixed tag match. They picked up the win with an assist from Edge. We got another countdown to Cody on this show, and Miz had the line of the night in the back when he said that Cody's ego is so out of control, he's got more pyro than the 4th of July. I was hysterical when I heard that. I don't even know why. It's not that funny, but for whatever reason, that tickled me. Because it's true. WWE had to move Money in the Bank from Allegiant Stadium to the smaller MGM Grand Arena because they could no longer afford to run the bigger building because Cody's pyro budget is so out of control. Can you imagine when he finally does win the championship? It's going to look like a fucking Michael Bay movie. We got Cody in the Miz for the second time. People weren't asking for it the first time, so they gave it to us a second time. And much like Cody's match with Austin Theory for the U.S. title, Seth Rollins interfered for the disqualification. This time, he shoved Cody off the top rope to the floor. After the match, Rollins yanked Cody's weight belt out of the hands of the fan that he gave it to in the front row, and he hit Cody in the back with it. When Cody limped back to his feet, he handed the weight belt back to the fan. What a babyface. What a great babyface. How could those evil AEW fans boo this man? Now watch them run this back a third time tomorrow night. How much you want to bet we get Cody against The Miz again on Raw tomorrow night? If they don't, then I have no idea why they couldn't just have Cody beat The Miz here in this match. Why can't Cody Rhodes pin The Miz and then have Seth Rollins run out to attack him? As predicted, the Raw women's title match at Hell in a Cell is now a triple threat match after Becky Lynch pinned Asuka to earn herself a spot in the title match. Bianca Belair was sitting ringside watching the match. Becky fell into her lap, and Asuka threw a kick that accidentally connected with Bianca when it was actually meant for Becky. So that'll cause some tension between Becky and, there's so many B's here. That'll cause some tension, I don't mean it that way. But that'll cause some tension, clearly, between Bianca and Asuka. Asuka almost got counted out, but as soon as she got back into the ring, Becky rolled her up for the pin. This was the fourth week in a row that the women have closed out Monday Night Raw. That has to be a record. I don't think that has ever happened before in the history of this show. The match at Hell in a Cell should be very good with these three in the ring together. They had a call in audible when Sasha and Naomi walked out, but we actually ended up with the better match on that pay-per-view. On Friday, they promoted another championship contenders match between Ronda Rousey and Raquel Rodriguez, out there looking like she's auditioning for a Colgate commercial. It was an angle, not a match. They got interrupted almost immediately by Shayna Baszler and Natalia. Of course, it then turned into a tag team match coming out of the commercial, which Raquel won with her newly renamed finishing move. Now that they've renamed everybody, they are moving on to their finishers. I haven't been this appalled since the FU became the Attitude Adjustment. The Chingona Bomb is no more. They are now calling it the Tejana Bomb. And it's such a specific change to the name. It's such a specific thing to do. I had to look into this and try to figure out why would they do this? What is the purpose behind doing this? On last week's show, the commentary was muted when they called it the Chingona Bomb, which the announcers did, but it was muted. And that seems very odd because the word Chingona is used to describe a badass woman, which is how Raquel portrays herself on TV. And I'm going to need some input from my Spanish-speaking friends on this, but apparently the word chingar is sometimes used in a very vulgar way. And either WWE or Fox decided that it was too risky to use the word. It sounds like they, for whatever reason, figured out all of this in the middle of the show last week, which is why the announcers said it, which they wouldn't have if WWE didn't want them to say it, and maybe the network was responsible for muting it. But I did what any normal person does when they encounter a word that they're not familiar with. I referred to the Urban Dictionary. And when the word chinga comes up, this is what it says. Chinga is basically like the word fuck. And the example it gives is puta chinga de madre, which translated means, go fuck your mother, whore. That's the greatest name for a finisher I've ever heard. Are you kidding me? Imagine winning the title in the main event of WrestleMania with that move. There's another online dictionary. I swear to God, that would be a fantastic finishing name move. There's another online dictionary that has chinga tu madre defined as fuck off. Again, I see no issue here. I think that's fantastic. But I guess it was too close in their eyes, so it's been changed. So it looks like Ronda and Raquel may end up as one of the teams in this future Phantom Women's title tournament that should never be held. I don't care about the women's tag team titles, and neither does anybody else. Except for Sasha Banks and Naomi, apparently. They're the only ones. But the one positive in what we saw on Friday is that Raquel is still being booked in a high position. Being associated with Ronda Rousey, the longer they keep the two of them joined at the hip, the more likely it is that she'll get another shot at the SmackDown Women's title. Especially now that, again, with the change in plans with Sasha, you know, walking out, there's really nobody else next in line that makes a whole lot of sense for Ronda Rousey. There are people they can build up. They could build up something with Ronda and Shayna Baszler. In fact, I hope at some point they do something with Ronda and Shayna. They didn't really share time in the ring together in that tag team match on Friday, but that could be a program right there. They, you know, bring up their history, bring up their friendship together, build off of that. A lot of similarities between the two, both from the fighting world. I would love to see them do something with Ronda Rousey and Shayna Baszler. The other people on that roster, Shotzi Blackheart, Xia Li, Aaliyah, I mean, those are just bodies to beat. Raquel, though, is somebody that they could push. I'd like to see her get a push as a heel. I mean, she just debuted. I don't think they're going to turn her that quickly. But for the time being, it's good for her because they've kept her looking strong on TV. There was a KO show segment with Sami Zayn. They had a nice little heartwarming reunion together in the ring. Of course, things turned sour very quickly when Owens basically said, "Dude, you think you're a member of the Bloodline, and you're not. You're not." And Sami didn't want to hear it, and so that was, you know, anytime you get interplay between Sami Zayn and Kevin Owens, it's always entertaining. But there was a segment in the back where after this segment, Sami confronted Jimmy and Jay. Roman was not on the show. He confronted the Usos and he said, "Look, guys, I want you to give me a reality check here. I thought we were, you know, cool or whatever, but do you see me? How do you see me? Do you see me as a joke? Do you see me as you know, one of you? Obviously, I'm not blood like you guys are," but he talked about wanting to be an honorary member of the Bloodline. And they said, "Sure, you could be an honorary member of the Bloodline." And then they walked off and Sami was all excited. And clearly, they're going to string this guy along for a while. But I'm looking ahead to, okay, where is this going? What is this building to? I think they're going to string this guy along for a while. In the end, though, we might get a Sami Zayn babyface turn out of it. Which makes me a little sad because I do very much enjoy heel Sami Zayn. But I think this could build to a Sami Zayn face turn and maybe even a win for him, even before he turns babyface, but a win for him at Money in the Bank. You know, we're going to have to start talking about potential predictions for the Money in the Bank ladder matches this year. You know, Money in the Bank is still over a month away. But when you start thinking about who can take the men's briefcase, right, there are different possibilities. You can look at someone like an Austin Theory. You can look at, you know, any number of people. Cody Rhodes is a name I'm sure that's going to come up a lot, even though I don't really support that. Or if Cody was to win, he certainly should not be cashing in after, you know, the champion just wrestled the main event match like a fucking coward. He would have to go the RVD route of announcing in advance, you know, a month in advance that he's going to cash in and challenge Roman Reigns. But what about Sami Zayn? Winning Money in the Bank just to make things a little more dramatic and then assuring the Bloodline, assuring the Usos, assuring Paul Heyman, let Roman know, "It's all good. I got the briefcase. Nobody else has it. I have it. I'm going to protect it. I'm not going to cash in on him. Because I'm with you guys." You can incorporate that into the story, but once Sami eventually finds out that he's just being played for a fool, all of a sudden things change. I'm not saying Sami is going to be the one to cash in and win the championship from Roman Reigns, but I just think there's a longer-term story here that could result in a face turn and possibly a Money in the Bank cash in on Roman Reigns. What happens at that point? Who knows? Again, I think the titles will be split fairly soon. Maybe Sami ends up with one. I mean, look, stranger things have happened. It's been a while since we've seen babyface Sami Zayn, but he was a fantastic babyface in NXT. Never really had the chance to be that on the main roster as much as he did in NXT. And he's been a heel now for so long, it's almost hard for me to even remember a period of time on the main roster when he was a babyface. But I like the stuff that Zayn does. I find it very entertaining, and I think there's a long-term play here. Drew McIntyre was indeed the New Day's mystery partner against Sheamus, Ridge Holland, and Butch. They had a house show match. It's the best way I could describe it. Send the fans home happy. You know, he was dancing with the New Day when the show was over. Ha ha, you know. Speaking of dancing, I forgot to mention this. Shanky and Jinder Mahal are on the outs. Jinder Mahal and Shanky were scheduled for a match on this show with Los Lotharios. Jinder was trying to find Shanky because their music is playing and he's nowhere to be found. And he goes into one of the dressing rooms and he sees Shanky watching television or... I don't know if he was listening to the music, but he's listening to their theme music and he's dancing. And he doesn't realize, hey, we got to go to the ring. And Jinder's all pissed off. Anyway, they end up losing the match because Shanky is too busy. He's not paying attention. At one point, he's on the outside of the ring. He's dancing, trying to impress Samantha Irvin, the ring announcer. And he doesn't make it back into the ring in time and Jinder gets pinned. And at the end of the match, Jinder confronts him on the outside and walks off. And Shanky is dancing, so it didn't take very long, but we have Shanky the dancing babyface. This is what they ultimately do with most of their big guys. It's only a matter of time before we see Omos trying to teach us how to Dougie or some bullshit like that, you know, because well, with WWE and their dated references, they're like me. They'll have him doing the fucking Macarena out there. It's only a matter of time. But we got Shanky the dancing babyface before we got dancing Omos. NXT 2.0, I'm going to spend about 2.0 minutes talking about this show because it doesn't really require any additional time beyond that. Not much to say about it. One bit of news coming out of the show, though, was the mention of Nikita Lyons being out of the women's breakout tournament with a knee injury. In a video posted on her Instagram, she said that she suffered a partial tear of her MCL and an MCL sprain. She didn't say how it happened or how long she would be out for. I don't think she'll be out for that long, but she'll be out long enough where she could not finish the tournament. And she was probably going to win the entire thing. So it's a pretty big loss in this tournament. Instead, Fallon Henley was to have gotten a bye into the finals. Except she was confronted by Tiffany Stratton, who took exception to her getting a bye and challenged her to a match. That turned out to not be a very smart move by Fallon Henley, who lost. And therefore, Stratton is now going to the finals. And Tiffany Stratton looked good in the ring. I mean, that probably was the best match I have seen her have to date in NXT. And she will now take on Roxanne Perez in the finals after Perez beat Lash Legend in the semifinals. I did not expect Lyons and Legend to both be out of this thing before the finals when this thing was first announced. But here we are. Cora Jade is all of a sudden very chummy on screen with Roxanne Perez like they're best friends. And they are again saying that the winner of the breakout tournament wins the right to challenge for the championship of her choosing. There are only two women's titles to challenge for in NXT. Remember in the Dusty Classic, the winners were supposed to get a shot at the tag team titles, and instead they chose to challenge for the NXT women's title. This time, in a singles tournament, I think we'll end up with Roxy winning and choosing to tag with Cora Jade to challenge Toxic Attraction and go after the women's tag team titles. We had a vignette on this show for a new NXT star that is on the way in. We never saw this person's face. We never even heard their voice. We had a female voice. But it was clearly a man who was being teased here. This was in Italy, and this man is a man of great Italian fashion. And his name is Giovanni Vinci. This might be the return, the repackage of Fabian Aichner. I can only hope. I mean, the guy is immensely talented. I don't know what they're doing with him, but it looks like this might be for him. This could be his new gimmick. It could be a horrible gimmick. It might be a gimmick that he, you know, it fits him and it suits him and he makes it work. But he's got a lot of talent. They have Walter on television with Marcel Bartel. They did not choose to call him up along with them. Maybe this is why, because they had another idea for him, but I just hope it's not a terrible one. But on a show where everybody has to play some kind of a character, whether they're a mob boss or whether they're a couple of beer-drinking cowboys, or we have a woman who's narcoleptic who walks around in her jammies, Tiffany Stratton is a daddy's girl who likes to play tennis. Everybody's got a fucking gimmick on this show. I hope that this will be one of the gimmicks that does not completely suck for the sake of Fabian Aichner, who is very talented. After Mandy Rose beat Indy Hartwell in a non-title match, she got jumped from behind by Sleeping Beauty, speaking of which, jumped in the aisle by Wendy Chu, with a giant sack of balls inside. And Wade Barrett had the line of the fucking year when he said that Chu was emptying the contents of her ball bag all over Mandy Rose. And then later on in the back, Chu said that she liked the sound of her sack of balls hitting Mandy in the face. Given the audience for this show, the audience that this show is supposed to appeal to, I'm sure there are lots of ball bags being emptied whenever Mandy Rose is on screen. There was really no topping that. I mean, where do you go from there? We're talking about ball bags being emptied. There's nowhere else to go. That's the NXT report. Everything else after that was pretty flaccid. A couple of questions here for the mailbag. You could email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Frisbee from New Jersey throws me a question. If Stone Cold's injury at SummerSlam 97 would have kept him out longer than a few months, what would the WWF have done? The only options I could think of would be basically beg Bret Hart to stay and find the money to pay him, have the Kane-Undertaker match before WrestleMania, and have a WrestleMania 14 main event of Undertaker against Shawn Michaels, or, if the screwdrive still happens, have WrestleMania be Shawn against Owen. And he says, I really don't like any option besides seeing if Bret would stay and have a Shawn and Bret WrestleMania rematch. What do you think the WWF would have done if Stone Cold was out longer? They would have shit their pants is what they would have done. But I think, you know, of the options, I think finding a way... See, here's the thing about finding a way to keep Bret. The only reason they didn't keep Bret is because they didn't have the money. So if Stone Cold goes down to injury, it's not like they're going to fire him or they're going to not pay him. They still have the money issue. The money issue still exists. Otherwise, I would say, yes, do whatever you have to do to keep Bret Hart under any and all circumstances. If we assume that it was a money issue that could not be avoided and that whole situation would have wound up exactly the way that it did, you know, I think getting Owen back when they did, and instead of building him up for a TV match, building him up for something bigger, you know, it's hard. I don't see Shawn Michaels against Owen Hart as a WrestleMania main event. Absolutely should have been the Royal Rumble main event, but not the WrestleMania main event. So there really are no great options. I would have done whatever needed to be done to get Bret to stay. But again, if it's a money issue, maybe they couldn't swing it. Maybe they would have had to have gotten a little creative and say, look, let's work this out contractually a different way. I would have done whatever it took to keep Bret Hart happy and keep him under contract in my company, because the last thing they could afford is for Austin to go down for a year and they lose Bret. It would have been a death knell for the company. Humphrey from San Jose. Buy, sell, and rent on these dream matches for Stone Cold Steve Austin. Hulk Hogan, Brock Lesnar, and CM Punk. In terms of ranking them as opponents, I would have to buy on Hogan, I would rent on Punk, and I would sell on Brock. Hogan-Austin was the biggest possible match they could have done that never happened. The Punk match at that time that they could have done it would have been, I think, pretty damn good, especially the promos building up to it. And Lesnar, by default, just ends up at number three. But you can't argue that Punk against Austin would have been a bigger match than Austin against Hogan when Hogan was still able to go. I mean, that is the biggest match they could have done that just never got done. The two biggest stars of the two biggest boom periods in the history of the company. Doesn't get any bigger than that. Although I have to say, I do think that Punk against Austin as a match probably would have been a lot better. But certainly no bigger than Austin against Hogan. That's all I got time for this week. I got a lot of prep to do for tonight. Obviously, the MJF stuff kind of threw me for a loop here, but we'll get back to more of your questions next week. Keep emailing me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. I am going to be live tonight after Double or Nothing. It's going to be a late night, after midnight probably, but come to the YouTube channel, hit that subscribe button, make sure your notifications are on, that way it will let you know when I go live, and you can join in the chat, you can send in your super chats, we'll talk about MJF, we'll talk about CM Punk, we'll talk about whatever news, whatever results, whatever new champions there might be, talk about your Memorial Day plans. I hope you do, for those of you here in the States who are off tomorrow and celebrating, have a very happy Memorial Day. Hopefully you'll have good weather and you'll barbecue and you'll have hot dogs and hamburgers and all that good stuff. You can grill, you can drink and grill, you can pour your drink on the grill, although that would be a waste of a drink. All right, my brain is malfunctioning. I'm out of here. I'll see you next Sunday for episode 759. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solomonsters sounds off.
If I was having a backyard barbecue for Memorial Day and I needed something to weigh down the tablecloth because it was too windy outside, I would want to have those women's tag belts to weigh it down and make sure that all my napkins and all my paper plates wouldn't go flying into my neighbor's yard. The women's tag team titles have been a joke almost from the moment they were introduced. I guarantee if they put little paperweight replicas of those belts up on WWE Shop, they would make a killing.
The Solomonsters sounds off. Each week, bursting with content. Podcasts, predictions, reviews, YouTube live streams, and more. Become a channel member for perks and follow the Solomonster on Twitter at Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Solomonster. Solomonster sounds off.